This month is Cliff Central's birthday month, and we'll be celebrating uncensored, unscripted, unradio with Savannah Premium Cider. Join me and the rest of the Cliff Central crew at Movida in Sunninghill on Friday the 29th at 9 p.m. for our first birthday party ever. Doors open at 9 p.m. Email info@movida.co.za for pre-bookings. For more information, find Savannah Premium Cider Facebook or Twitter, and all the details on cliffcentral.com. It's our party, and we'll dry if we want to.
It's time for a WeChat workout. WeChat. Go to the Cliff Central account, tap connect, then message to show. On radio. On radio. More of the good stuff. CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned in to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name is Kingsley Kipuri, and I'll be your host for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by Daily Maverick reporter Greg Nicholson. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you, man. We've got a great, great show lined up. We'll be talking about illicit financial outflows from Africa, as well as talking to a renowned author about challenging the stereotypes about Zimbabwe. But first, Greg, I want to talk to you about something you've been following closely. A couple of months ago, just to give some context, we saw the xenophobic violence flare up in some areas of South Africa, so namely KwaZulu-Natal and some areas in Gauteng. And we had terrible scenes of foreigners being chased out of their homes and some even being killed. And the immediate response from government was I think quite worrying. We wasted a bit of time talking about xenophobia versus Afrophobia, and we saw some countries actually flying some of their citizens back home. Eventually, we saw the army coming in, and the president was granted access to the army and actually have them operating in the country, which is, I think, whenever we have the army being deployed internally, it's something we should be watching. And you've been doing just that, Greg, haven't you? Greg, you've been following this closely. So, I mean, my question is just really, really broad. Firstly, what's the army actually up to?
It's actually a good question. Yeah. I think when President Zuma, I think it was around 24th of April or towards the end of April,
yeah.
President Zuma announced that in his statement, he said 338 members of the SANDF would be deployed to assist the police in terms of to help maintain law and order in KZN, Gauteng, and anywhere else where they're needed. Now, that was right in the midst of outcry of xenophobia, and it was also right after Emmanuel Sithole, as he was known then, was killed in Alexandria, where we saw him on the front cover of the Sunday Times. Yeah. And that was sort of one of the key symbolic moments in really spreading caution about xenophobia throughout the country and throughout the world. And so we saw the army deployed after that, and I think everyone watching immediately assumed the army was being deployed to curb xenophobia.
Yeah,
that
makes sense, right? And that's people who were being injured, being chased out, being killed.
Yeah. And the defense minister effectively said that. But President Zuma's statement explaining the deployment didn't actually say that. He just said it was to support the police to maintain law and order where the need arises.
Okay.
And so effectively what happened quite soon after that attack on Emmanuel Sithole in Alexandria, there weren't too many more incidents of these xenophobic attacks. It actually sort of quietened down because of the response, particularly by civil society and government leaders and police. They really cracked down on this stuff, and we saw a decline in reported incidents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the army was still deployed, particularly assisting the police on Operation Fiala Reclaim.
Yeah.
And so you say, what do they do? What do they do if these xenophobia incidents aren't going on anymore?
Yeah.
It effectively seems to have turned into a crime combating program and operation.
Mm.
What we saw initially was it looked like the army was being deployed with the police to go into areas where foreign nationals particularly reside, areas like Mayfair in Johannesburg, Hillbrow, then later on the CBD of Johannesburg. Well, one of the symbols of where a lot of foreigners are is the Johannesburg Central Methodist Church. The police and army were deployed to all of these areas, and they arrested quite a number of foreign migrants, allegedly who didn't have the correct documentation. On Sunday, the latest update that we have got from this Operation Fiala Reclaim was that there are 3,914 people have been arrested, and 1,650 of them are undocumented migrants. I'm not sure whether those numbers include people who have been taken into the cells and then they actually have their papers and then, released or not. But the government's argument was this is definitely and categorically not a campaign to target foreign nationals. That's what they're saying.
Okay.
Though the reports we've had from people who have been targeted are quite different. The government is saying that what this campaign is for is largely to combat South Africa's crime problem, really. But the question is then, why do we have the army?
The army is not a crime. It's not a crime fighting.
Why do we have the army deployed to combat crime problems, which the police should take the mandate on? A lot of people are asking, why hasn't the army gone to the Cape Flats, where there's a lot of gang activity, and the Democratic Alliance government in the Western Cape specifically called for the army's intervention, but they were never deployed. So at the moment, it's hard to know actually what's going on and what the army are doing there assisting the police. It actually just seems like it's just this big now crime-fighting operation where many foreigners are still being swept up. And we've seen incidents of those arrested in Johannesburg. They're being denied their rights when they're being detained. And it's sort of spiraled into this thing that's this beast that, now it's almost, I hate to say it, but sort of reminiscent of stories, that you hear in apartheid, where you have the armed forces on the streets, kicking down doors and asking for papers and arresting people for a little bit of dacha and stuff like that.
Absolutely. I mean, a few things on that. I saw a statement where Lawyers for Human Rights had said they've reached an agreement with the army and the police, and everyone now arrested has a right to consult a lawyer. And that makes me think, what were they doing before? If they're only just agreeing to this now, and they're promised not to deport the foreigners for at least 2 weeks. So there have been stories of deportation on site, if I'm not mistaken, where it almost seemed as if they were literally arresting people and deporting them almost immediately.
So the story there is really worrying and could signify a whole lot of other problems as to what's going on with this Operation Fiela Reclaim. Yeah. So what happened was the army and the police went into the Johannesburg Central Methodist Church, where everybody knows there's a lot of foreigners sort of squatting there, I guess. They're allowed for a long time. And surrounding buildings where there are a lot of foreigners also sort of staying in the Johannesburg CBD.
Yeah.
They swept up a whole lot of these people. Some of them supposedly even they asked for their passports. People showed them and they said, no, futsek, come, just get in the van. They even arrested South Africans in this process thinking they were foreign migrants.
If you don't have your ID ready on site, then you off to Zimbabwe, Malawi.
Yeah, it's right. Jesus. So these people were swept up, and detained. I think it was a few hundred people or something like that in the one morning recently in Johannesburg. Then, so obviously news of this spread pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So there's the Lawyers for Human Rights tried to get down there to see some of these guys who were detained. The police refused them access. And I'm not sure if the police know, and it's very worrying that these foreign detainees, foreign national people who have been detained, have the same rights to legal counsel as South Africans
Absolutely.
Do. And what seemed to be happening is immediately they were getting processed by Home Affairs officials to either facilitate deportation or send them to Lindela processing centre for then deportation. But some of these people are asylum seekers and refugees, and either they've applied for their permits or their permits have expired, and that doesn't mean you can just deport them straight away.
Absolutely.
And then these people, they were getting their legal rights denied. So Lawyers for Human Rights went to court the day it happened.
Okay.
Court told the police minister and the police and the station commander of the Johannesburg police station they have to give them access to lawyers. For two more days, they refused. It wasn't until Monday that the majority of these detainees were actually granted their rights and could see lawyers. And so it's an extremely worrying situation if a lot of these people are getting swept up in this, which Fiela essentially means, like Operation Sweep. A lot of people are bringing it back to that dreaded sort of term, sweep up the rubbish.
Absolutely.
Which says a whole lot more about how the state views the targets, I guess, of these operations. But the thing is, this is the only real case that I've seen, at least, where lawyers actually jumped on the case and actually tried to go to the assistance of these
such
detainees.
A short period of time, yeah.
When there's something like 3,900 people who have been arrested across the country, you wonder how many others have been denied their rights. How many other stories are there, not even of just foreigners being arrested and denied their rights, but South Africans being arrested for no apparent reason?
I mean, Greg, something you said a few times, that whenever you have the army patrolling the streets and just being used as a regular crime fighting force, it's already worry. I mean, I think one other thing I'd really like to bring up really quickly is the township of Tembekile, and that's somewhere, and that's something you reported on, that there was no incidence of xenophobic violence on there, but suddenly the army was there, and what were they up to?
So that's the question. Yeah. They said there was, yeah, all of these attacks seem, yeah, to come from criminal intelligence sources and tip-offs about criminal activity in certain areas. Tembekile isn't known as particularly prone to violence more than other informal settlements, but it is known for its independent political movement that is highly challenging the ANC. So that's the worry.
Jesus, man, that this is really something we need to keep watching, and as you mentioned, when the army's patrolling the streets, we need to be worried. But Greg, just briefly, we need to switch topics quite quickly and talk about illicit financial flows flowing out of Africa, and we'll be talking to somebody who spent a lot of work working on this, Professor Thomas Poggi. Professor, are you here on the line? Hello, Professor.
Yes, I am here.
Fantastic. So we will be just be talking to you about a conference you had yesterday and the work you've been doing at the Global Justice Program about illicit financial flows. Now, when we hear the term illicit, you hear finance. I mean, we could be talking about terrorism money. We could be talking about drug money. So what kind of is the focus of the work you're doing when you're tracking these global financial flows?
Actually, by far the largest portion of these illicit financial outflows are by multinational corporations and individuals. So the criminal components, the terrorist components, they exist, but they are vastly smaller. They use the same channels, but really the big outflows are multinational corporations and individuals.
And Professor, what sort of money are we talking about? Because it's astronomical figures that I don't think a lot of people know about.
It's basically an attempt by multinational corporations to evade taxes in the countries in which they operate. So they have obviously subsidiaries in many different countries. They set up subsidiaries in tax havens. Then they do business between subsidiaries in the developing countries where they do business and the tax haven subsidiaries that are detrimental to the former and advantageous to the latter. And in that way, they shift profit out of the developing country into the tax haven, where, of course, the profit doesn't need to be taxed, right? There's no taxes to be paid on it. And that means they can have a lot of profit in a developing country without paying the usual taxes that would normally be due in that country.
Now, Professor, I think it was the Global Financial Integrity Report that conservatively estimated that between 2003 and 2012, something like $529 billion American dollars left sub-Saharan Africa through illicit flows. Now, how does this money link to human rights?
Well, in two different ways. If that money had stayed in Africa, of course it would have had tremendous multiplier effects. The money would have been invested in some way. It would have been spent. There would have been work created for people. And so the economy would have benefited. And secondly, if that money had stayed, then taxes would have been paid on it because these are for the most part profits or they are investment capital that also where you have to pay taxes on the dividends, on the interest, on the capital gains. And so for every dollar that flows out, African countries lose about 20 cents or 25 cents in tax revenues as well.
And one of the interesting things here seems that often when we talk about the failure of particularly African governments and sub-Saharan African governments to substantially improve the lives of the majority of their citizens, it's often the politicians we blame. But in this instance, it seems like large multinational corporations are undermining states and politicians.
Yes, that is entirely true. Of course, there is enough blame to go around. I'm sure that politicians also are to blame for their spending priorities in many ways. But it is true that, and this is an estimate by Christian Aid, if the money were not flowing out and stayed and were taxed, and if it were spent according to the existing spending priorities of governments in the developing countries, somewhere around 350,000 child deaths each year could be prevented with that money, or would be prevented with that money, just by spending the money in exactly the way governments are now spending it.
Mm. And it seems to also fit into the global pattern of increasing inequality. What we have here is it seems that money that should be going to governments or particularly poor nations are instead being pocketed by huge corporations making billions in profit.
Yeah, that is exactly right. So it is one example of the centrifugal tendencies that are at work that are increasing and increasing inequality. Of course, these mechanisms at work that companies are exploiting, that rich individuals are exploiting, these mechanisms are ones that are deliberately put in place, often with the connivance of Western countries who are benefiting from this system as well. And here it's an example of how rich and well-connected companies and individuals can buy themselves the rules and regulations that in turn benefit them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Make them even richer and even politically more powerful.
I mean, just when you're describing it, it almost sounds like I'm trying to think of where to start in tackling this, and it sounds like a tough one, because if we have the multinationals, you know, with the Western countries complicit in making this happen, and if we've got local politicians also in on this whole transfer of funding, then where does one start in trying to combat this?
Well, you can combat it in different ways. Mm. One very important way to combat it is through transparency,
okay.
Right? It's a difficult topic, and it's very hard for ordinary citizens to understand it. But if citizens try a little bit, they can understand it, and we have to communicate it as clearly as possible,
okay,
to get citizens to force governments to be transparent and to close these loopholes.
So, Professor, what then should citizens be demanding from their governments? What would be perhaps the three or four top priority demands that we should actually say to our governments that we want implemented so these illicit flows can cease?
Okay, so number one would be for all accounts,
yeah,
the beneficial owners have to be known. No more secret accounts of any sort. Second, automatic exchange of financial information. So governments should demand from one another that they give each other information about their taxpayers having accounts in other countries. Third, multinational corporations should report their profits and losses country by country.
Okay.
No longer just a global general accounting, but for each country, what are your operations there? How many employees do you have? Because that would quickly show that companies make huge profits in secrecy jurisdictions and tax havens where they have basically no employees. How come? And then in very big countries like South Africa, they have thousands of employees and no profit.
Mm-hmm.
So country by country reporting is very important. And then maybe a last thing is we have to stop trade misinvoicing. So very often there are discrepancies between what a company tells the country from which it exports and what the company tells the country into which it imports.
Mm.
And those things have to be consolidated. There must be no discrepancies between the import invoice and the export invoice.
But Professor, it seems that doing this could be quite a challenge, particularly in sub-Saharan African states where number one, or any states really, where number one, a lot of politicians are accused of being in bed with, even if they're not responsible for this, still being in bed with large multinational corporations. And number two, citizens are often denied a voice and avenues to express themselves as to making demands from their governments.
Yes, that's right. And that is, of course, something that needs to change, right? We have to democratize the officially democratic states of Africa and frankly, of the Western states where I come from as well, right? Democracy is sick also in the United States and also in some of the European countries.
Yeah.
So, yes, citizens have to have more of an input. And first and foremost, input and accountability begins with information. Citizens have to learn, or at least some organizations, civil society organizations, NGOs, have to learn how this money is being siphoned off and have to try to explain that to the general public. And the public then has to support these organizations in demanding accountability from politicians. you will not be able to get these illicit financial flows down to zero. Totally impossible.
Okay.
But you can definitely get it down to half its present magnitude, and that already would mean that half the losses that Africa is now experiencing in terms of healthcare, in terms of education and so on, half these losses could be avoided.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned that for every $1 for an investment, 84 cents is leaving illegally. And when I hear that, it's astounding. And I think of just how much work could go into, you know, into public health and education and so on if we just managed to keep some of that money at home.
Yes, that is exactly right. And I have to say that when I first came to this topic, yeah, I was also just flabbergasted. I couldn't believe that it is vastly more than all the foreign aid that flows into Africa is just dwarfed by the outflows.
Yeah.
Now, Professor, one of the things you mentioned in your keynote speech yesterday was particularly about the reasoning for why we should continue to tackle human rights deprivations. And I think it would be nice if you could elaborate on that a little bit. I think one of the examples, what you said was poverty is avoidable at a tolerable cost, even if poverty... the situation's better than 1990, or those are my notes, you know. What you're saying was that although as humans we've made extreme advances, you know, within a few generations, and we have had some advances in access to human rights, there's still so much to be done.
Yeah, there's certainly a tremendous amount to be done, and we tend to exaggerate the amount of aid that we give and what we have achieved. And here, I think one thing that is very important to bear in mind is that we shouldn't think of the problem of development as one which requires assistance, right? Often the rich people in the world, both within the poorer countries and also in the richer countries, they think of themselves as being benefactors, as doing wonderful things to help poor people and so forth. And I think that really the relationship is quite different. They do an enormous amount to harm poor people, in particular through a network of rules, both at the international level and also at the national level, that systematically is biased in favor of the rich and thereby increases inequality. So one thing that is really astonishing is that with all that development aid that has been given with its Millennium Development Goals and so on and so forth, inequality is increasing, and the share of the poor in global income is actually decreasing. The poor would be better off without all that heavy lifting of poor people out of poverty, as it's often called. They would be better off if they just got a proportional share of global economic growth.
And finally, Prof, before we let you go, I just want to emphasize or ask, how, in terms of ending global human rights deprivations, how important is this issue of illicit financial flows? Is it the most important? Is it in the top few?
It is definitely in the top few.
Fantastic.
Just in terms of the order of magnitude. Of course, there are other issues as well. But just in terms of how many resources would be released for poverty eradication, this issue dwarfs all others.
I mean, thank you for your work, you know, with Yale and the Global Justice Program for making sure this is in that top few. Is there any way we can support what you're doing, at least follow and make sure that we're keeping this on the agendas of our leaders?
Yes, you can definitely follow that. We have an extensive website, which is the website of the Global Justice Program.
Yeah.
I also run an organization that is called Academics Stand Against Poverty.
Yeah.
Or ASAP,
yeah.
And I'm on the board of a third organization, Global Financial Integrity, that also has a wonderful website with a wealth of information.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Professor. Please keep up the great work you're doing.
Yes, you're most welcome.
Okay, fantastic. If you're just tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick, Sean Cliff Central. We started off with a really interesting conversation with reporter Greg Nicholson, who's tracking what the army's up to around the country. That's Operation Fiela Reclaim. And as we've said a few times, whenever you're seeing the army in the country, we really need to be worried about what they're up to. When they're on the streets and they're going into communities, you really need to be worried about how long will they be there, what exactly are they up to.
I think one of the key things is that we can't normalize the SANDF deployments.
Yeah, I think that's really the key point, as you've mentioned. And secondly, is what's the priority here in this Viela reclaim? As you've mentioned, Viela means sort of sweep up, and those connotations can be quite worrying. So what exactly are we sweeping? Who are we sweeping? Is this really about going against the people who are fighting and kicking out and sometimes even killing foreigners in South Africa? Or are we actually just accelerating the exit of immigrants into the country? And a big thank you to Lawyers for Human Rights for keeping up the work they're doing. We're just going to take a short break and we'll be right back just after this.
Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team in.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm joined in studio by Daily Maverick reporter Greg Nicholson. And actually, we're in quite esteemed company for the second half of this show. I'm joined by Dr. Robert Kavanagh, who will be talking about his book, Zimbabwe, Challenging the Stereotypes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Fantastic. Now, this is something we wanted to talk about. I think in the South African sort of dialogue, Zimbabwe, I think, has been unfortunately belittled into just a cautionary tale. It's just like, if we're not careful, we'll end up like Zimbabwe. And I think in that, we've lost so much about the details of what actually has happened and did happen in Zimbabwe. How did it get there? What's actually going on? And I fear it's become, you know, not much more than that. So it's really great to have you on the show to shed some light on this.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Now, actually, before we get to the book, I'm quite interested to hear about your personal story. I mean, from South Africa, how did you end up in Zimbabwe? And how did your story with the country end up in you writing this book?
All right. Okay. Well, I'm South African to start off with.
Yeah.
Born in Durban. Ended up, I suppose, at UCT. Got a Rhodes Scholarship from UCT. Then I went to Oxford, came back and taught at Wits. And then I left for Leeds to do my PhD. And at that stage, I was married to Tembani Ndianene. So we stayed there, and from that, once I'd finished my studies, I didn't want to stay in the UK.
Okay.
So I looked around for places which would be compatible with what I was interested in, which is basically cultural transformation in a revolutionary situation. And Ethiopia, there was a place in Ethiopia, so I went to Ethiopia. I was 4 years in Ethiopia.
Okay.
From Ethiopia, then I found another situation in a similar set up in Zimbabwe shortly after, once again, a big change and a country which we hoped was concerned with cultural transformation. And so I came to Zimbabwe, and I was at the University of Zimbabwe for a long, long time. Then I'd finished in about 2011. I'd done my work, handed over the various things I was doing.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I'm a South African. Let me come back to South Africa.
Yeah.
It seemed to make sense. I came back. I was 2 years in South Africa, and I said, no, I think I'm much happier in Zimbabwe. Let me go back. I had a house in Zimbabwe, so that was easy, and I went back, and that's where I'm there to stay.
Okay, fantastic. I mean, I love that you're actually living there. I think a lot of the narratives and stories about Zimbabwe are written from people far, far away who browse a few, you know, articles and then put something easy together. Now one of the first myths you rubbish, so to speak, in the book is this idea that Zimbabwe started as the breadbasket of the continent, and that, you know, it was feeding literally the whole continent until all this doom and despair came about. And you say that's not really the case. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I must admit, I do my best not to try and rubbish anything. I try and challenge ideas. And I'm not the first. It was made easier for me by the fact that Professor Ian Schoons from Sussex University in England did really what was a groundbreaking research, because Zimbabweans had done it.
Okay.
But if Zimbabweans come up with this research, it's not acceptable. Yeah. They say, oh, this is just a ZANU-PF, follower, etc., and they don't pay any attention to it. So it was very important when a respected English academic came and did some solid research with a Zimbabwean team in one province in Zimbabwe, in the Mashingo province.
Yes.
And then he came up with this book, which was called Zimbabwe's Land Reform, Myths and Reality. And he selected a number of myths, all of them really revolving around the land reform. And he proceeded not to rubbish them, but to use solid evidence.
Yes.
With testimonies and statistics to show that most of what was being propagated in the media, particularly, I have to say disgracefully, in the South African media, but in the corporate media generally over all the world, as things which are everybody just takes for granted as being true. And people were not challenging or didn't have an interest in challenging them. And he shows how that, in fact, they're largely myths. Either like a myth is not always, is not completely untrue.
Mm.
A myth always has an element of truth in it. But they're certainly not facts like they're propagated. And this breadbasket idea is just one of them. I mean, I try and look at a whole, I mean, every chapter basically is concerned with a stereotype which it is trying to take on. First of all, the whole idea that at independence, Zimbabwe had everything going for it.
Mm.
Then others like the Gukuruhundi so-called massacres or genocide, if you like, in the west of the country, so-called Matabeleland. The involvement of Zimbabwe as part of a SADC force in the DRC. The fact, and the biggest of all, is sanctions. We're just told over and over again that there are no sanctions, or they're just targeted against certain political cronies or travel sanctions.
Yeah.
The sanctions that have been levied and imposed on Zimbabwe are blanket. The U.S. sanctions on Zimbabwe are such that they affect every aspect of economic survival. And the point is, as we all know, once the U.S. imposes sanctions of that kind, all the others have to fall in. So the EU tries to keep squeaky clean and say, oh, no, it's just a question of armaments and travel bans, etc. But they know that they are applying the very same sanctions because the U.S. are applying them. And if they go against them, they're in trouble.
I hear you, and I think it's so important to bring this kind of nuance and sometimes just plainly disproving with facts what the media is reporting that isn't true. I think you've touched on one thing that I think is really important to dig into, is the question of land reform. It's something that in South Africa has become the hot topic with the economic freedom fighters, and there's often reference to Zimbabwe on both sides. So on one side is that the land reform was a complete failure, and it was a bloodbath with the uprising of the army veterans, and on the other side is Zimbabwe is the only truly free country, and we must all emulate Zimbabwe. And there seems to be nothing in between. You've got people who are saying it's perfect and we must be like them, and people saying it was a massacre. So I mean, I'd love if you could just talk about your writings on this and of the other book from your fellow professor that you said specifically focused on the land issue, just to shed some light on the land reform question and where should we actually find ourselves? Because obviously these two narratives that I've pointed out are so extreme and biased. So where actually is the truth in all this?
Well, Kingsley, it's interesting that at least this kind of discourse has appeared.
Yeah.
The idea that Zimbabwe, and knowing the facts about Zimbabwe, have any relationship or can be beneficial or instructive in any way to South Africans.
Absolutely.
That is now on the map is very important. And this comes back to why I wrote the book. I'm a South African.
Yeah.
I have not written it for Zimbabweans. The Zimbabwean discussion is, as you say, as you've mentioned now, this kind of discussion about land reform, totally polarized. It's very, very difficult if you're an outsider to come and talk to either side.
Yeah.
If you've had the experience, for instance, of talking to Eritreans and Ethiopians, a fact is not a fact. You know, it's an emotion. And it's the same sort of thing in South Africa, in Zimbabwe. So I never wrote the book for Zimbabweans. Mm. What I was really concerned with all along is I was concerned about my own country, about South Africa. Yeah. I felt that what I was watching over all these years was a series of extraordinary historical events, very, very important in terms of their significance for countries all over the world, but particularly South Africa. And I wanted South Africans, because I felt that South Africans, number one, unfortunately, have a certain belief initiated, I think, in the apartheid period, yeah, that Africa has nothing to teach them.
Absolutely.
That they're a unique, different country. Mm-hmm. And so that they tend also to be very ignorant about what happens north of the Limpopo. And therefore, they are very susceptible to propaganda. So I think that that's what they've got from the press in this country, even the SABC most of the time, and definitely what they've got from the big international media. So I just wanted to write something which would tell another story. And at the same time, I felt that people all over the world, progressive people, people who realize that another myth is that what you get on these international media is the truth.
It's always the truth.
Yeah. we're looking for another story. I've come across so many people who sort of want to say, look, is it really like that? And I simply wanted to tell another story. And why I particularly wanted to tell it to South Africans is I felt that South Africa is the closest country in Africa. Zimbabwe is the closest country in Africa to South Africa. There are a tremendous amount of similarities. It's not the same, yeah, but there are a tremendous amount of similarities. And I feel that if South Africans had been watching carefully and had access to the truth and to the reality of what was really taking place and were trying to applied education, experiential education, take what was going on in Zimbabwe and start taking stock of our own situation here in South Africa and begun to discuss it and possibly come up with better ways of handling it, I think that would have meant a lot. And I think South Africa wouldn't be in quite the situation it is today.
I mean, I really hope so. Yeah. Sorry, if you're just tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We have someone on WeChat, Iggy, asking how to listen to previous shows. Please go to cliffcentral.com, and if you click on the podcast link, all our previous shows are on there, as well as all the podcasts from all the other shows on. So back to Dr. Robert Kavanagh talking about his book, Zimbabwe Challenging the Stereotypes. I think, Greg, you have a question.
Yeah, Dr. Kavanagh, you're saying that if South Africans were attuned to the realities of what was going on or what's been happening in Zimbabwe, perhaps the country would have chosen some different pathways. Can you give us some specific examples? What might be different in South Africa if we focused more realistically on Zimbabwe's affairs?
Well, I think the one that you've raised is the whole question of the wealth and the land. We know that South Africa has become even more unequal than it was 20 years ago. In fact, I believe it is the most unequal country in the world, yeah, economically after Brazil. Mm. And I feel if they had realized that, look, when the people were fighting in Zimbabwe, they had a song, Simuka Zimbabwe, and it speaks about Tinoda Nyika, right? Tinoda Nyika, Neufumi Wayo Wose. We want the country, but we want the wealth with it. It's not a question of just getting the country and having your own person as president. Mm. You know, what was important during those struggle years is that the country is a wealthy country. It has resources. It has the capacity for happiness, the capacity for a better life. And independence or democracy should be the key to unlocking that. Zimbabwe, how Zimbabwe handled that would have been very interesting. And then how the circumstances that led to Zimbabwe precipitately taking over the land and then moving for indigenization of the economy and ownership of the economy and the development of one's own resources financially, etc., to develop the economy. If I think South Africa had watched that, I think they could have seen that in South Africa, a similar process must take place, because the same denial, the same abnegation is taking place, and the people are just as unhappy and as deprived as they were in Zimbabwe. We see the response of the people in Zimbabwe, the combatants, the government itself.
Yeah.
Now, surely, if we look at that, the lesson is on the wall for those who have the wealth in this country. People say, why not be so sorry for the commercial farmers? In all those years, they had an enormous percentage of the land, the fertile land. They knew it. They had taken it. And they had handed over the rest, barren, not good rainfall, etc., to the others. Surely it must have occurred to them that, look, the struggle was to have a share of this, to redistribute or develop this together. Surely they must have had a twinge of conscience. Why did they not, right from the beginning, begin to avert what happened later by coming up with strategies and discussions whereby they were prepared to bring people in, to share the resources, to divide their farms? Because they had farms that were so ridiculously big. In the time of Rhodes, they were just being donated like they were figures, you know. Share their farms, use their farms to train other farmers, and together work towards a situation where they could produce a more equal economy. In Zimbabwe, it is largely the land. Here, it is more than the land. It's finance, it's industry, yeah, it's mining, you know, it's the land as well. And that has to, well, for myself, yeah, looking at the situation in Zimbabwe, if I was a South African, and if I was a South African who was wealthy, somebody, the financially ruling class, I'd be saying to myself, look, this is going to change. It's going to have to change. These people cannot be denied for all this time. Something is going to happen. Look what happened in Zimbabwe. And why am I not working together with government, working together with others in the industry and with other organizations to try and find a solution which might be better for the country eventually?
Okay. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's great that we can, that with the understanding of some of the details behind what's going on in Zimbabwe, we can actually, there are actually some lessons. I hate this sort of cautionary tale thing. That's it's almost like the boogeyman, you know, you would tell with kids, like, be careful Eskom, or be careful Jacob Zuma, or else we'll end up like that. So I love that there's still some lessons here. I mean, something that comes up so often is the role of Robert Mugabe, and how much of this is actually can be ascribed to one person. So how much of it is actually just the colonial legacy and playing out and the people demanding what was theirs, and how much of it is actually just the will, the force of will and of one person trying to shape the country through what he sees as being the right way forward for the country. So how much do we ascribe to him, and how much is actually just the context?
I want to get back to something else.
Yeah.
And that is linked to my question, why are you playing U.S. American music?
Sorry, just for context, when he walked into the studio, we were playing Drake, and he wasn't so happy about that.
Yeah. I worked for a long time with a children and youth organization. We used to have young people coming up from South Africa.
Yeah.
And black kids, children. And despite what they'd heard about Zimbabwe, almost all of them loved it and loved being there and loved moving there and loved and felt that they were free. And I'd like to refer to the book Coconut. In my latest book about Gibson Kente, the great South African playwright, I've taken a quote from it, which is basically, we can't walk around in our own way. We can't be free to walk around in big groups, to talk loudly, to laugh our Mkomboti laughs. This is what you have in Zimbabwe, because the issue is not, and because I'm from the cultural sphere, the issue is not about legislative change, just legislative change, or material advancement and development. It is about cultural change. Now, by culture, people tend to departmentalize, compartmentalize. Yeah. I'm not talking about the arts. Yes, that's important. But the culture is the broader. How do we live? How do we behave? What are the images we see around us? Yeah. Is this a really a country which you can call a rainbow country, or is it a white country? The feeling about Zimbabwe when people go is that you are really in an African country. And you don't have that feeling here. And I think and I think that that's another thing, that whatever has happened, whatever the losses, whatever the risks, Zimbabweans have created a country where the majority of Zimbabweans now feel that the country has been refashioned in their image.
I mean, there's a quote from your book that I love that you said, even if all the myths were true, it was better that it happened the way it did than not happened at all. And the land and all its wealth now belongs to the people.
And that's one thing I want to follow up on as well, is that in terms of the land reforms in Zimbabwe, did they in some sort of way precipitate or create this feeling that it's an African country for the people of Zimbabwe? Is that a strong part, or was that already there before the recent land reforms in the last 15 years?
I don't think it was just the land reform. I think the land reform has to be seen in a wider context. Mm. And it's basically this Zimbabwe tried to be another kind of country. It went to the IMF. It got into terrible problems. It was thrashing left, right, and center. It was trying its best to bring the benefits of education and things like that to the people, but it didn't have a strong enough finance base to do it, and so it was running into debt. Then the feeling now was, we will not do this unless we unlock the land. And they tried to have conferences to try and get support for that. They tried to hold the British to their undertaking to support that. And it wasn't working. And I think that when they went for the land, they broke the taboo. They broke the sense of wanting to be a Western country, wanting to be approved by England, approved by America, wanting to keep up standards. There was this thing about standards that ruled and in a way stymied the way in which the country developed. We must show them that we can keep our country just like the Rhodesians had it, keep up the standards, etc. But there was never any interrogation of those standards. Yeah. Can we afford them? Are these the standards? Whose standards are those? So I think when they broke all that and when they took the land, lots of things happened. For instance, one of the big things was the transformation of the media. Before, they had tried to be fair, tried to balance, etc. Mm. Now they simply said 75% local content. This is Jonathan Moyle. And suddenly, the creative talent that was unlocked amongst young people all over Zimbabwe, this came at the same time as digitization. So anybody could get a laptop and start recording, making a video, etc. And I remember in the early days, the songs that came up, many of them were out of tune. You got them, oh, gosh. You know. Yeah. But those very, I remember Pedzenai, one of the singers, she used to sing like that. And I remember I had to go to the ZANU PF sort of conference center for an independence cultural. And Peds and I was on the program. Oh, my God. Boy, when I saw her, she was a talented, confident professional, no more singing out of tune. And I think that was another thing. And the jingles, which sounds so much like propaganda, which are singing, Zimbabweans, keep on fighting, take the land, let's farm the land, etc., played over and over again and sung in townships all over the place. For me, a shaping moment was when I was at a beauty contest, I think, at the conference center. And the people who attend that are not ZANU-PF. They're usually people who oppose it, people who don't even listen to the radio. But then the band struck up one of these jingles, and the whole place got up. And I think it was at that point when Zimbabweans said, we are Zimbabweans. Let's be Zimbabweans. Let's do things our own way and to hell with this pretense. And I think there was a major cultural change. And I think that this emphasis on culture, that is the need for cultural transformation, for creating a society that is in the image of the majority. Steve Biko was on the ball, where he said at one point, people think I'm against integration. Then he said, if by integration you mean that I must enter into a world which has been where the mores, the conventions and the values have been decided by the white minority. No, I'm not in favor of integration. So the point is basically, if we want a rainbow nation, you never have it now. This is something you'd have to fight for. The rainbow is always on the horizon. It'll take a long time to get there. But the answer, you can't have a rainbow nation when one color is totally dominant. And that's the same with everything. The majority culture, in my opinion, I know that at one stage when people were during the sunset clauses and during the negotiations, yeah, the newspapers, yeah, were equating, your newspapers were equating majority rule with tyranny. They were terrified of majority rule. I'm not terrified of majority rule. And I think that that's what we need. We want a country which caters for the majority, is not just ruled by the majority, caters for the majority. The majority participate and share in it, and it belongs to them, and the culture reflects this. And then majority is not a white thing or a black thing. I feel I'm part of that majority. Anybody of any race in South Africa who feels that common identity as all South Africans, a South Africa that is ours, all of us, is the majority.
Doctor, but one of the interesting things about that integration with the majority is if you do look at South Africa, it's quite common for white South Africans not to try to adopt that majority's culture or language or interest in those customs. Where it seems you have in Zimbabwe reflect quite a lot of these things in terms of the languages you speak, the topics you're interested in, and all these different things. But is that common in Zimbabwe? Is it for white people in Zimbabwe, is it much more common to be incorporated into the culture of the majority, unlike South Africa?
I'm South Africa. So I never went to Zimbabwe and then became interested in all these languages. It was South Africa who made me like that. People sometimes, they say, when they hear me speak Zulu or Sotho or something, they'll say to me, they'll be surprised. I say, why are you surprised? Here in Gauteng, most people, the majority, speak 5 or 6 languages.
But what I was saying is, nothing. Most whites don't.
No. No. Yeah. I mean,
I'm sorry. Yeah, so, unfortunately, yeah, Doctor, so that's all the time about. We have. I'm sorry. A big, big thank you to you for coming on the show, and we'll make sure to go out and get the book from your publishing company Temba, and we look forward to much more coming from the company. So thank you for writing this and for coming.
And we no longer have time to say what the next title is.
Okay, we have like 3 seconds.
Three
What's
seconds,
the next title?
Right? The next title is Footprints in Stone. Yeah. The Zenze, Women of the Zenzele Movement in South Africa by Mango Chabango.
And when can we expect it released?
In the next few months.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you, Doctor. Tune into the Daily Maverick Show next week.
CliffCentral.com.